Great, I'm allowed to start, fantastic. So in case you hadn't guessed, my name is Oscar. I work for Unity. I do a lot of hopefully interesting talks. You can be the judge of it. Like I say before, best tweets get these. If you can't spell my Twitter tag, don't worry, it's not your fault. I chose a really odd one. You can find me on the hashtag GameDevCamp. I'm pretty prolific, shall we say. Anyway, so I'm going to try and talk to you about making fairer IAP. Can I get you to put your hands up if you think the free-to-play is evil? Anyone? Free-to-play evil? You're wrong. And well, free-to-play has been done evilly. Okay, fair enough. This talk I've done a lot to try and help indie developers who are not come from a commercial background realize that this magic thing of making money is actually a thing called game design. Seriously, and I'm going to try and prove that to you. I have 42 slides to give in 40 minutes. So this may be a bit fast because I want questions as well. But don't worry, I'm going to bombard you with information in a foreign language for most of you, and somehow you're going to feel wonderful at the end. Right. Do we like this? Hands up if you like seeing a game that tells you that you're going to basically spend £3.99 or wait 21 minutes. Is that good? Does that make you feel good? Happy? I mean, it's not a terrible game. I mean, it's not my kind of cup of tea. It's actually quite a successful game. But it's a roulette wheel type game. How about this? So I'm going to tell you the first thing to establish the talk is we have to accept a couple of things. The first one is that games is a leaky bucket. We are going to lose customers. We are going to lose, let's not call them customers, let's call them what they really are, players, fans. We are going to lose them. There is nothing you can do about that. Now, of course, don't get me wrong, we can try and plug some of the leaks, we will never plug them all. We will try and keep hold of these people as much as we can, and some of them will leave feeling really good about our game, and that's brilliant. But we have to accept that we're going to lose some people. They're not going to stay with us all the time. Because we want to get more water going in than coming out. That means we've got to actually attract people, retain them, and understand what keeps them. Retention matters. This is the second thing I want you to understand in terms of getting, you know, success as a game. Retention is a massive factor for people being willing to spend money. Massive. I mean, there's 10 hours plus, and you're getting $15. If you get less than an hour, you're getting an average of 0.66. That's the people, 45% of which said they were people who spent money in games. It was a survey, online survey, so please don't assume it's fact. But it is still, 3,000 people online saying this is their behavior. Less than 1 hour, 66. 10 hours or more. Now, we're not the only ones who've done similar surveys. The PlayFab guys have also identified that if you spend more than 10 hours playing, you're 60% of people who spend 10 hours playing are going to spend money at all. As opposed to what we normally hear, that of the number of people who download the game, something like 2% are going to spend if you're doing a free-to-play game. Now, what that says to me is that we're basically comparing the wrong things. If we think that someone who downloads a game is a customer, we're nuts. We're idiots. Someone who downloads a free game is testing it out. That's not a customer. It's barely a suspect. You know, we have this idea of suspect, prospect, customer. They're not even a suspect of being a customer. So let's remember what they are. We have this tenuous relationship with someone who downloads a game. So tenuous, in fact, we can't even guarantee they'll click the icon. So App Annie did a survey, I think it was something like 80% of apps never get played twice. In fact, some of them never get played at all. A scary number. Never even get played once downloaded. So we want to avoid that. How do we avoid that? Let's do some psychology here. Now, actually, this is it's actually more marketing. I'm a trained marketeer. When I realized I wasn't patient enough to be a coder, talented enough to be an artist, and too gobby to be a game designer, I decided to become a marketing guy. And so I studied marketing. I'm a member of the Chartered Institute of Marketing, all that kind of stuff. I'm a designer, really, but I had this paid me money. This is a diagram actually from the 60s, I think it was, in the one of the sort of Institute of Marketing kind of magazines. from America, actually. It's all about consumer behavior as risk. Now, I've played a lot of liberties with it, so apologies if you want to actually look it up. You can't, it's just me playing around with it. But the central message behind this is relatively solid. Anyone buying anything, buying shoes, the latest headphones, t-shirts, whatever it might be, goes through a buying process, and they have buyer anxiety. We generally don't buy anything because we're too busy worrying what other people will think, what the opportunity lost if we buy this and not something else. We don't know what the thing we're getting is going to give us. We don't really know until we've got it. And then we've got other things in our lives we should be doing. So that I want you to think of those three things. So a leaky bucket, retention is good, and people don't buy things unless you give them a reason to resolve these anxieties. Are we okay with that? Everyone all right with that? Yeah, good, good. Cool, that's what we need. Right, some typical solutions that exist right now. Let's have unlimited content, or the perception of unlimited content. In Candy Crush is a bit interesting because there is a finite amount of content, and that's part of the draw, because I feel like I could complete it, but in practice I can't, for well, most of us anyway, because there's lives in the way, the difficulty level, the amount of time it will take, all that kind of stuff. But there is the perception of unlimited content. If I want to get access to that, I'm going to have to spend money on these add-ons or these lives. Okay, that's one solution we see right now. The next one is, anyone you recognize that, I'm assuming? Yeah. Anyone not play Clash of Clans? Really? Wow. Yeah. I've known Ilka for a very long time. When he was Sumia, we actually gave him an award to be the first 3G game on mobile phones, first 3G mobile phones. So I've known him a long time. And I cringe because I totally respect Clash of Clans, but I don't like playing it. Anyway. But what it did brilliantly is introduce to the market this idea of this ratchet system. So what they've done is this exponential cost to continue. And I think if you get to, is it level 14 or something? It takes like 2 weeks for something to upload. Someone will tell me differently. But it's amazing how that particular method was all about ratcheting up the cost and the time and so on and so forth. So that's the other method we have right now. And the other one, Puzzles and Dragons. Has everyone played Puzzles and Dragons? Anyone not played it? Not played Puzzles and Dragons? Okay, so you probably should. So what they did here that I think is magical is that they basically had this idea that we're going to have continuous events. My favorite one is described by a friend of mine, Toy Baderman from Blue Byte, Ubisoft, and he talks about really this amazing breakdown of the game. In particular, his collection of Hello Kitty. This is a hardcore gamer, and he delights the fact that when they had Satori doing characters inside Puzzles and Dragons, he collected them all. And he shows them off. He's happy to show off his Hello Kitty collection in Puzzles and Dragons. Now, what does that say? There's a magic thing that happens if you have this continual relevance that's updated continuously. Now, the first two, in fact, all of these three things, I'm wondering, do these games leave you feeling joyful? Do they always leave you anticipating the next thing? Do you know what your expectation of reward will be from playing these games? I'm not always sure we do. Now, I use these games as examples because they're really well done. Have you looked at the top 100 list lately on the App Store? Basically, they're all, the top 100 lists are essentially divided almost equally into thirds of these three types of games. Actually, slightly less this last one. The casino games are also relevant there as well. There's a lot of games which are essentially cloning these methods, but not how the companies got to those methods. That's a very important distinction. A lot of people are cloning, oh look, there's a successful free-to-play game, let's do that with a new skin. Is that good? Are we happy about that? I'm not. Now, there are some good exceptions where they did do a brilliant job of it. So Next Games did Compass Point West. Really nice Wild West style Clash of Clans. Actually, I really enjoyed it. They introduced a few new things, particularly the way that you collect your kind of forces. You get these cards that you booster packs you open up, and it feels really good. Best Fiends, you know, it's a really nice, emotionally kind of attractive game, and they've done a really good job with that. So it's not, I'm not saying that all games that copy these are bad, but a lot of them, a lot of game designers are doing it blindly without understanding why they work. I'm going to try and tell you about this. Park and Lee, two psychologists in South Korea, did an analysis of why people spent money in in-app purchase. Do we think it's because games are happy? If you think it's people buy because they're happy, do you want to put your hand up? Do people buy in your game because they're happy? Good answer, no one put their hand up. Do you do it because you think you should give something back to the developer? Anyone? Yeah, couple? You're so rare, and only developers put their hand up to that question. Actually, that's not true. I mean, there are exceptions. Okay, the Humble Bundle being a fantastic example of that. People do that kind of stuff, but it's rare. It's not going to make anyone a living, and I want you to make enough money to at least make the next game. That's what I consider to be success. I'm not expecting you to come away from this and suddenly have billion-dollar companies overnight, I'm afraid. I know that may be why you came, but, you know. Oh, yeah, get out. However, if you focus on what these guys in Korea worked out, I think you've got a chance of doing well. And that's by focusing on the player's expectation of value. What I mean by that is that you have to, if you're going to hand over your hard-earned cash to somebody else, you have to have an expectation that thing you're buying is going to give future value. Who thinks giving away a sword that gives you plus 10 damage is pay to win? In fact, anyway, who thinks pay to win is a thing? Do you think pay to win is a real thing? Anyone? Go on, hands up if you think pay to win is a real thing. You're wrong. It's a broken game. No, it's not real. It's a broken game. You've simply broken your game. True. Pay to win is a mistaken design idea. If nothing wrong with paying to get something in a game, but if that purchase makes you win, you have no game anymore. There is no game if it's pay to win. And pay to win is only if it makes you win. But there are lots of really clever things you can do about it. So let's go back to this thing. The other thing that's really interesting, I've done in-app purchase stuff in games. I probably launched the first variable pricing model in mobile games in 2003. At the same time, I probably launched the first in-app purchase. That in-app purchase was based on this idea of rent games. So you would rent the game. So you'd go into the game, play it, and say, do you want to play this game for 3 days? Buy, yes, no. Dong. It was a complete disaster. Seriously, it was a complete failure. And the reason is that we had a 26K jar file limit on a mobile phone at that point. Our API took 6K. So no one could make big games on these original mobile phones. You just couldn't do it. So we couldn't get developers giving us enough content. So of course, this stuff is a disaster. Really weird thing happened because we're doing this rent and buy. We discovered games that had rent and buy sold 3 times as much as those that only had the buy. Why did that happen? Because of the short-term and long-term risk to the player. So we have to think about this. Players are not static. They're not just, they come in and they are the same person at the beginning as they are at the end. Anyone heard of whales, as the term whales? Do whales exist in games? No, they don't. They do, of course they do. But what they are is not people. I'm not a whale. It's not very complimentary, is it? I mean, okay, I look like a whale, but most people don't. The point of a whale is not the person, it's that you have engaged them and delighted them to such an extent that they are willing to hand over the kind of money that you would hand over to buy your console every month. Now, that thing about that. And actually, think about how many of us spend more than, say, $50 a month on games. Come on, you're game developers and you don't do that? You're amateurs. I'm not going to tell you how much I actually spend on games. I do get to expense some of them, so that maybe makes it a little bit dubious. Anyway, so I want to try and focus on this idea. So what happens there? And I want to avoid this thing, playing and paying fatigue. So what we do to help with that, we need to see comparative progress. Has your game got comparative progress? If you don't let me show people how I'm engaging with your game, then we don't get over that social issue we talked about earlier that creates that anxiety. If you're constantly giving people escalating costs over the long term of their life cycle playing with you, what's that going to do to their willingness to carry on playing? It's going to impair it, isn't it? If you're going to have this idea that you have no idea of ever stopping spending and you'll always have to spend more, anyone play Kim Kardashian? Seriously, go do it. It's really fascinating. It's a beautifully polished clicker game. And I genuinely wanted to go and change my makeup rather than going to take another shot, with the photographer. So, or am I alone here? Okay, so, come on, man. So you feel my pain, and it's a crazy thing. But you know what I mean? You always felt that you could never spend enough money. And that does fatigue you. And of course, we have an infinite supply of games right now. There are more games out there already on iOS alone, let alone Android, let alone Steam, let alone console, than I could play in my lifetime. Okay, I'm older than the rest of you, but I think it still applies to most of you. You know, that extraordinarily vast amount of content that we've created. Bearing in mind, of course, that anyone know what the median... So let's go for the average first. The average revenue per game, lifetime game on iOS, anyone have a clue? $5,350. Dollars lifetime. Anyone know what the median revenue for a game on iOS is? $400. Anyone know what the average cost of making a game is? Well, this is a bit more dubious. I'm not sure of the source of this one, but the quote I saw on the website that I was getting all this data from was $25,000. Think about the net loss of most games. How do we avoid that? By thinking about this stuff. This is the stuff that helps us think differently. Realizing there are substitutes helps ground us. We have no right to assume people carry on playing our game over time. We have to encourage them to continue playing. And if they want to pay, and value the free player, because they create the context for people who continue to pay. Now, the reason I say about this idea of over time is because of this graph, which I basically cruelly adapted from the Gartner hype curve and misused entirely. This happens to match my experience running game services for about 17 years, so it's not wrong. But it's not based on huge amount of, well, not as much scientific data as I would have liked. But what happens with you when you have a price on a game up front? If you choose, anyone making a premium game in the room? Okay, yeah. That's interesting. How many of you are making free games, premium games? Okay, so that's an interesting matter. And I used to say premium was dead, and anyone who makes a premium game is a zombie, living dead, they're dead, they just don't know it yet. But I've stepped back from that because that was a bit unfair. Actually, premium can work. And the reason it can work is this. If you get me over this anticipation, when I get to buy a remorse, because you always have a bit of remorse after you purchase something because you're going to question what you did and why, was it worth it? And you will try to self-justify as well. You think about those trainers that you bought, you shouldn't have done, but you justify it to yourself. Yeah, that was all right. But in your heart, when you first get them out, and they're not right. They're the wrong shade of green or whatever it is. That buyer almost happens every single thing we buy. So if you made a premium game, anticipation, you had to build up that desirability, you get them to buy it, fantastic, they bought it. You probably only get a tenth of the people who might have bought it had it been free. Okay, bought it free, but you know what I'm saying. A tenth of the people would have downloaded it otherwise. But when you get to this stage, they've already invested. So they don't quit here as much anyway. So you actually keep your player longer. So that's why until free-to-play came about, we didn't actually give a monkey's what happened to a player after it was launched, except from the point of view of reviews and whether they told anyone about it. We don't actually have a vested interest if we're not measuring what people are doing. And why are we measuring them? Because if they're going to pay us over here, not over here, we have to do it better, don't we? I argue we have to make better games if we're going to do free-to-play. The crux, though, is if you've built a game that happens to be one-time playthrough nugget of absolute joy, absolutely right to make that paid. But why would we do that for most of the time? Because actually we can make some nuggets of joy that we can continue to release with dynamic content and adjustments specific to players. That'd be amazing stuff that we can do now, keeping games alive. So if we're free, this height is lowered because we haven't got the barrier of paying. But to assume there's no barrier is also a mistake. Back to the infinite content. We have so much content available. But we're still going to get this. And the reason I'm going to say that, give you an example of why that works, it's going to be unrelated to mobile. It's going to be to do with Xbox Live, being in the right place for that. So I'm going to get a poll from you about trailers and demos, or both, and which we think is going to be most effective. So if you think that a demo is going to be the most effective way to get people interested in your game, can you put your hand up? Demos? Anyone? Got a few demos? Okay. What about trailers? Trailers? A lot more hands for trailers. What about both? Who thinks both is going to be effective? Okay. Well, the best one is trailer. Demo is the worst of them. In fact, demo is slightly better than nothing, don't get me wrong, but it's not particularly effective. Why? Because when you go and play a game and you physically get to play it, all your illusions of how the game might perform are gone. You can't imagine what that game might feel like to play because you're playing it. So you've got no room for imagination left, and worse yet is you don't know the controls. So you actually have the worst experience possible when you first play a game. So that we have to think about that. When we're doing these free-to-play games, we're actually going to be giving all these vast number of people the worst possible gaming experience. So you've got to think about that, and you've got to plan for that. So we have to create expectations. We have to build social capital. Why do people want to play this game? How can they show off in the game? How do we create a sense of fear of missing out? This is how we get over this idea of the opportunity cost, if I buy this or not. Well, if I'm worried about the opportunity cost of me making a purchase, the fear of missing out means I can get around that. If I can give you a reason, buy one, get one free. We human beings are compelled to go for that. Get this while stocks last. Starter pack, only available today. This kind of sense of it can be misused. I'm not suggesting you misuse that. I'm just suggesting from a psychological point of view, as designers, this idea of creating an imperative, a call to action, is really powerful. And we're designers, we're about creating emotions, aren't we? In fact, the job of a designer is about manipulation. You know, we all do it, that magic moment where you go down the corridor and the zombies are chasing you, automatically turn left, and later on you realise there was no right turn. You've had that moment? There is never a right turn. That right turn doesn't exist. They built a sort of corridor, but it's blocked off, and you're never expected to go down there. The way the lighting is, the way the monsters are chasing you, the way the sound effects work, you're trained to turn left to where the dungeon really is. So that happens as manipulation, that we're kind of setting people up to behave in particular ways. Same thing applies to how we then want to encourage them to want to spend money, but we have to be responsible about that, and I'll show you why. But we also have to create an expectation of delight. All of this stuff applies to in-app purchase just as much as it applies to the premium game. Abnegation is a bit weird. We have other things we should be doing in our lives, but one of the things that games does is it allows us to escape and feel competent. So abnegation is kind of a willingness a player gives themselves. You can't do it, but willingness a player gives themselves to set aside the other things they should be doing. In my case, it's always the washing up. Now, I talked about Kim Kardashian earlier. What Kim Kardashian does is create this sense of unfinished business. This is the Vega conflict game, and they're kind of showing you there's got continued relevance. There's going to be something I can come back to and unlock even more powerful things. Anyone know what this is? Or rather was, sorry?
PlayStation Health.
Oh, I love you. So unfortunately, my baby is no longer. I used to work on PlayStation Home. I was home architect, which basically meant I had to deal with the politics between Japan, America, and Europe. This was the gold suit, as the gentleman rightly said. The gold suit, at the time it was launched, was the most expensive item on PlayStation Home, hugely popular. People used to try and time it so they could all turn up in the same room, all wearing the gold suit, because they were hardcore fans. What was lovely about it is these things here, animated money coming out of the pockets. Why would anyone want a suit like that? It's ridiculous. That's why they wanted it. And that's the thing, is it becomes a communication tool. So how do you get that, and how do we build repeated engagement? Well, we've got to build on authenticity. I mean, the home thing is silly, but it was authentic. I mean, home was a massively kind of playful community. I mean, there were, I think, let down by Sony, but then I'm bitter and twisted, so I shouldn't probably be unfair to them. But here was a virtual world community that wasn't given the resources it deserved, in my opinion. There were something like 38 million downloads of PlayStation Home. There was something like 3 million monthly actives at one point, and they were spending something like £11 a month. So there's about 3% of those spending £11 a month. That was possibly the most successful online service Sony's ever had. But it didn't feel like it, because it was sort of swamped with all of the other kind of aspects. If you weren't part of the community, you didn't necessarily get Home. But that authenticity really mattered to that community. Having a continued relevance, and again, you could argue there wasn't enough relevance for Home. And I shouldn't talk about Home too much, but the point is that this stuff, you know, unfinished business, the sense of unfinished business, why I should have to come back the next day and do that and do that, that's what delivers the retention. The retention delivers the opportunity to convert people. But we still need triggers, and we need to avoid these triggers to churn. If you have a lack of engagement, if you have this playing fatigue, if there feels like an opportunity cost, I'm missing out on something, and your real life, all of these are why we have a leaky bucket. These are all reasons why people will leave. So I'm going to try and talk about goods now, the kinds of things we can sell. This is supposed to be about fair in-app purchase. I'm going to try and give you some examples of how to create fair in-app purchase. I've tried to create it in a systematic way by breaking down the kinds of things that we have in a game. These are like paintbrushes to use in your art as a game designer. These are techniques that have a real-world impact in terms of gameplay. Sustenance goods, things I need to continue. If I don't get the health potion, I die. I can't carry on if I'm dead. Therefore, I need a sustenance good, a health potion to continue. A health potion is a perfectly legitimate thing to have in a game. Monetizing that is a perfectly legitimate thing to do, provided you do it fairly. So, you know, this is the kind of first type of good, the sustenance good. It doesn't have to just be energy drinks, it could be fuel. It could be how many moves you've got. It could be how much resource you have to allocate to the things that your actions can then do and have to wait for your actions to recover. All of these are still sustenance goods. Then there's shortcut goods. So these are the arguable play to win thing that we talked about earlier. But these are about making it easier to succeed. There's nothing wrong with making a game easier to succeed, but it can be quite helpful if you showed people when these goods were used. If you know that somebody was headshotted by this amazing mega gun, not only are they showing their skill, but they're showing the ownership of that mega gun, and at the same time, if you don't have that mega gun, you know not to necessarily compare your ability with its. By communicating up front, you actually make it more attractive to sell. But shortcut goods, we do it all the time. We have shortcut items in games all the time. Monetizing it, again, is entirely fair, provided we create a structure that makes that feel good, not exploitative. Social goods, we talked a bit about social goods. Now, this is a bit more kind of tenuous. I'm going to argue that Angry Birds Fight, the goods that you like, the mustaches and so on and so forth, are social goods. Why? Because when I go and play with somebody, I don't necessarily have a social interaction with them, but I know that they're a real person. When I see they've got this awesome moustache and this shuriken, that's kind of good. I get, oh, that's they've got moustaches and shuriken. I'm now exposed to something other people are doing. I get a sense that the game is alive and played by other people, and that makes me feel more connected to it. So these are still social goods in my mind. Social goods aren't necessarily just cosmetic, but it's their cosmetic aspects that are part of why they're defined as social goods. Then there's strategy goods. Now, this is my personal favorite, and I think vastly underutilized. The most obvious example, obviously, is in the Hearthstones of this world, where each card is a new set of rules. Fantastic. So every time I make a purchase and I get booster packs with new cards, I'm adding to the complexity of the game. I'm adding to my choices in the game, which you don't have if you haven't bought any. So, and there's nothing wrong with that, because if these are done right, if these are balanced, and what they're doing is they're providing alternate ways of playing the game, they're providing colour and flavour, but not breaking the gameplay, this is an amazingly powerful thing to do. And it's one we all feel good about. Anyone bought content in Hearthstone? Yeah. Do you guys feel good or bad about buying booster packs? Good. Why wouldn't you? And if you get a free one, how do you feel about that? If somebody gives you a free card for watching a video ad, do you feel good or bad about that?
Even better.
So this is the thing. It's a realizing that if it's not the fact of in-app purchase, which is scary to people, or unfair if you're specific, it's the way that we think about it strategically. Then there's different forms. These goods can take different forms. So the first form here is a consumable. Well, I know about the consumable. Here's my health potion. I drink it. It's gone. Nice and easy. I have my fuel in my tank in my CSR racing. When I've used up all that fuel for those races, it's gone. I've got to wait for it to refuel. They're consumable goods. They're gone, but they're easily replenished. Beauty for a game developer of a consumable is it's a database entry. There's no art needed to be made. Once it's done, it's done. I can sell an infinite amount of them. Fantastic. But in some ways, this is also potentially the risk as a designer, is the realization that if we have this and it becomes overpowering, then we create a sense in that player that there is never-ending cost. We don't want to create that sense of fear that is associated if you think it's a money sink. I think that's a potential problem. People are delighted to buy things when they give value. Let's make sure we keep the value there. Then there's capacity. So obviously in this case it's Sims City. It's how much storage I have for the items I collect. That's great, it makes sense. How big my fuel tank is in a racing game, how much ammo I can store, how much gold I can farm, all that kind of stuff. Capacity is a really kind of undervalued thing. But also think about it. If I have a constitution in a role-playing game and I increase my constitution, I've just increased the capacity of hit points that character has. That's capacity too. So thinking about these things generically is also interesting. Anyone played this game? How many? Anyone who's got any space left? Yeah. You've got amateurs. I am completely full. I actually did slow down because my plan is to keep playing until Fallout 4 is released. In the vain hope, I know it's not going to happen. In the vain hope that they do something magical where they connect your game to the actual game. But I know that won't happen. I just have that sort of desire as a designer. I want to do that sort of thing. But I'm still playing it, even despite the fact that I have built every building, I have every weapon and every piece of outfit, and I'm still playing it. I'm not sure why I'm still playing it. I think it's just sheer bloody-mindedness, sheer determination. But the point of raising it here was this. When I upgrade my water treatment unit, I'm getting more production and I'm getting more storage. I'm actually getting a generator of extra things I can only benefit from by coming back and playing the game. That's a really interesting thing about generators. If I have an alchemist I hire for my castle, and the alchemist can give me 10 crystals of energy every day, and I just get them every day, I've now got a reason to go back in every day to get my 10 energy crystals. Because if I don't go back in every day to get my 10 energy crystals, they won't build any more. I have to, it's only got a storage unit of 10. So if I go back every day, I'm going to get so much more value of what is spent on the generator. So think about those kind of things and what that means for you. There's another type, which is called a permanent. In this case, this is my spaceship in Tales of Honor, which I really enjoyed that game. As you can see, I'm being destroyed badly. But the point was that it was my ship. And I upgraded it, and I placed objects in it. But the point is that each new stage, I had an aspiration of the bigger ship. I wanted that bigger ship, that ship upgrade. I had a desire and anticipation to get that. But the weird thing is, once you get it, that value is gone. It just becomes part of the normal baseline of my game. So let's say I get a Vorpal Blade, which is from Alice in Wonderland. The Vorpal Blade lets me kill Jabberwockies. I want to kill Jabberwockies. Yes, let me have the Vorpal Blade. I buy the Vorpal Blade. I've got the Vorpal Blade. I can kill Jabberwockies. Well, yeah, okay, I've got the Vorpal Blade now. And it's good to have a Vorpal Blade because I can kill Jabberwockies and you can't. That's great. But, they're just another monster. So think about these kind of things. Each of these types and forms of good are like colours and paintbrushes. It's how you as a designer use them to encourage players to engage in the longer term and to have an expectation of future value. And I pulled this grid together just to give you a taste of that. So let's say we've got a sustenance good fuel as a consumable. Great, we've got consumable fuel. We're going to have a fuel tank to put that in. We can make the fuel tank bigger. We can have a petrol station, which is going to give us the amount of fuel every day. And we can then have a better car, which uses more fuel. But we want the better car because the better car is cool and it goes faster and does all this great stuff. But we now need more fuel to put into our fuel tank, which we can then get an upgrade to get a bigger fuel tank. And then we want to upgrade our petrol station so we get more petrol every day. And then we want a better car. Now that's a ratchet kind of system, arguably. But it shows you that we can think differently about the flow of the game and the flow of the things that you might want to purchase. And there's nothing to stop you creating an ethical kind of approach to it so that you build that into the flow of the game. Things that you can buy, things that you can't buy, things that are exclusive, things which are personal, things which feel like they're rewarding in the game. Similarly, strength potion, I can get greater strength, so I can increase my strength. And therefore, when I get my strength potion, it has more effect. I can have an alchemist that can make me strength potions. I can have an improved recipe that gets me better health potions. The list goes on. So I want to try and kind of, even things like this, the door key in King of Thieves. I've got a key to get me into the next level. I can have a new tool that lets me do a new thing with my dungeons to protect them better. I can have a daily booster which lets me, do something cool as I'm trying to take other people's dungeons. There's a whole bunch of things that I can do. There's also a whole bunch of other things we can think about. Bundling can be cool. So I can get pack of 5 for 12 as opposed to a single one for 5. We can do that. That's classic sales things, a bit kind of, but actually can be very valuable. I think this would have been really useful in the context of Candy Crush. I don't know about you, but I've never bought the lollipops that give you 5 more moves. Just don't do it. But if they'd sold me a pack of 10 for 69p, I would have done it. The reason being is I'd use one, and if I still didn't finish, I could use the next one. And if that worked, I then would have 8 more left to use. 8 more that I have to come back and play the game more in order to use them. So that's not cynical. That's about knowing the value proposition to your player. That's the important thing, is we're focusing here on value proposition to your player. No idea how I'm doing for timing, but let's say a ratchet can be useful. I mean, in this case, this is the Blades of Brim game, and you get so far through the run, I got this far. If you know the game, you'll know I failed a few times before I got there. There was some loot I hadn't stashed yet, hadn't got to the stage where I could stash it. But if I revived, then I would be able to continue going and I wouldn't lose this good. So think about what that's doing. It's telling you this is the stuff you're going to lose unless you actually get involved with the business of this game. But actually, I can revive. I've only got 1 revive left. How do I get more revives? Do I either buy them or watch video ads? Now we're starting to sort of see. And the interesting thing, the reason why this is ratchet is because first time it costs you 1, second time it costs you 5, third time it costs you 10. It carries on like that. So if you keep using this in the game, then it feels, okay, and it gets more dangerous. But the really interesting thing is I can just go back and do the run again. There's nothing to stop me doing the run again, but I will lose these. So it gives you a sense of what you're missing out on. It makes this run feel more valuable. Makes you feel more engaged if it's done cleverly. Equally, all of these techniques can be done badly. The other thing I think is always often forgotten and particularly important for strategy goods is scissor, paper, stone. We don't have to have a +10 sword. We can have a fire sword of +10 that, because it's a fire sword, means it works really well on earth, but really badly on water. So now, having this really powerful weapon isn't just a decision of magnitude, it's also a decision of strategy. Have I thought about what this enemy might be? Am I prepared for that enemy? Have I select the right items? Can I buy the better items? And it's interesting, because if you make the generic stuff work across the board, but the paid for stuff or the premium stuff, something which is subtler, that's using some intelligent strategy to it, you can actually increase the scope of the game's strategy field, the kind of engagement of the game as well, all through using in-app purchase. And don't forget customizing as well, because customizing can be huge. I want this character to become, it's Spellbound, that's right. I want this character to be something I connect with. Have you heard of a thing called character identification theory? A lot of work that's been done on that, particularly around things like Lara Croft and why we want to see someone like Lara in front of us, particularly guys wanting to see a girl in front of us rather than guys wanting to see a big butch, thick, you know. Whole bunch of questions. Not that I'm not casting judgments, I'm just saying it's, you know, interesting. But we want to identify with these guys. Well, if we've dressed them, if we've given them their armor, if we've invested in their things, we've invested in them. If we've invested in them, we've invested in the game, we're more likely to go back and play it. So in-app purchase isn't just about making money, it's about engaging better and more deeply. That has the benefit of, well, keeping our studio alive. Another thing that people forget about, and like I said, I'm not sure how long I've got, I'm going to keep going. Another thing that people forget about very quickly is that in-app purchases have to scale. It's all very well having 5 outfits, fantastic, I don't care, because you're going to run out of things to buy very quickly. You know, we have to make sure that we can use these, the idea of custom or limited items, this logic of scissor, paper, stone, having additional strategies, the idea of bundling, all of these things, and help us target how we're going to scale our game. And that's kind of a really important thing. You know, having 1 or 2 items to sell isn't any good. I'm still think the jury's out on this one, but I'm going to ask you what you think. Do you like that buying something gets rid of ads? Anyone like to buy something in order to get rid of ads? Anyone like that? Yeah, I'm not sure. I genuinely don't know the answer. My instinct is that it's bad for the player because you're essentially telling them that watching ads is bad. And okay, there's a whole different topic I've done on that one. I'm not going to tell you about that one. Go look at the Unity blog. There's a great big piece on using video ads, which explains why I don't like a lot of other forms of ads. But the reason I don't like it is because you're also saying that to the advertiser, you can't have our best customers. You can't have our best customers look at your game. And it just feels wrong to me. Anyway, my point being, scale matters. Scale matters in all these things. Without scale, you're going to fail. You also have to have added value. You know, think about this. The whole point of this is an expectation of value. If you don't have an expectation of value, we've got nothing. People don't buy outfits because they're cool looking. They buy them because they have a value. That value is either aspiration or rarity or about personal identity, or it could be even functional. And every good, whether it's about outfits, whether it's about swords, whether it's about consumables, always has to realize what value it's adding. Why should I, as a player, care? How often do you ask that question to the things you add? Why should I care? It's possibly the most important question. And you shouldn't be asking for yourself because you're biased. It's your game. Think about it from the player's point of view. Why should they care? And there are lots of other things, so we can have help from friends, and that can be overused, admittedly, but it's still quite cool. Free first-time use, that's kind of quite a useful thing to do. My favourite one there is this one. Anyone recognise that game?
Yeah, it's Crossy Road.
Yeah. Anyone not played Crossy Road? So go now, play it, seriously. I'd say that every time I do a talk, because it is a masterclass in creating a free-to-play game that makes you feel good. And this is an example of that. When you get the emo goose, everything turns grey and miserable and rainy. I love it. I genuinely love it. There's another one called Frankenstein. Yes, it's Frankenstein Monster. And basically, it turns black and white. And there is flashes of yellow lightning. Just love it. The really fascinating thing about this idea of predictable uncertainty. They use the gacha model deliberately, and they kind of make a joke of it, but they've done a brilliant, beautiful gacha. So I get coins. I watch a video ad, say, and we, just so you know, we paid them $3 million in 100 days just from video ads on iOS. So the opt-in video ads have been very successful for them. So you got coins for watching these video ads, and you got coins from playing it, and you then got these coins to spend on the gacha machine. The gacha machine would give you a random character. I got the celebrity. I don't like celebrity culture. It's not my thing. I got a celebrity. That's how I play it. And it's a girl in a little pink miniskirt walking across the road. Fair enough. Yeah, whatever. And then these paparazzi turn up and take a photo. That's quite cool. Then she hits a van. Puff of money. Love it. If it's that good and I got a random one, I had to go and buy one. And that's the really interesting thing. If you want the one you want, you have to buy it. If you're willing to get a random one, and actually those random ones are always delighting you, then you're going to go with the predictable uncertainty. You're going to want to have the video ad. And the magical thing that they do is you don't get the option to watch the video ad all the time. You only get it once every 4 minutes, and they give you a timer. And I actually start finding myself actively waiting just that minute more to get the next video ad. It's crazy. I could just come back later, but I choose to stay playing because I've got a timer to tell me to do that. And that wouldn't work if their in-app purchase wasn't beautifully, seamlessly connected with the emotions of the player. Limited offers, great. You know, we talked about kind of the sort of uncertainty thing. Unboxing experience. This is from Compass Point West. Their unboxing is beautiful. It really, really feels special when you open up the deck and it kind of, you know, feel it kind of crisply opening out, like a fresh. Anyone done that? Opening up a fresh deck of real cards? This is the next closest thing to that. It's like virtual sex with magic cards. Okay, I'm old and married, so what can I say? But the nice thing is I can upgrade that with in-game goods or with premium goods. That's interesting. So I can get my basic pack, and the basic pack gives me good stuff, and then nothing's wasted. So I get four basic cowboys. I can merge them into one superior cowboy. I get four superior cowboys. I can merge them into an advanced cowboy. So nothing's wasted. That's really important to this. Nothing is wasted. But I can speed that process up by spending in-game currency, which then slows my other stuff down. But that's okay. You know, I made a choice. Or I can spend some premium currency and just get the mega ones, which speeds up my game. So there's an anticipation of value. And the process of unveiling these things is joyful. That's the kind of stuff we're talking about, making you feel good about playing the game. And then there's landmark items. I want that. I mean, actually, I'm not a big fan of that car, but never mind. But let's say that's a car I love. I've got that car at home. I don't, but if I say it was, I don't think Prius Hybrid would really kind of work on, you know, on the Real Racing 3. But hey, I'm always tempted to say, go do it. But if you've got your car or the aspirational car that you want, that becomes something, it becomes a landmark item. I want to reach out to it. And when I get that stage, it doesn't just show me the thing I wanted. It also gives me a sense of purpose and progression. I have the Lotus Elise, therefore I'm happy. And I'm told to hurry up, so I will. Also, show me what I've already bought. You know, the ones to the left I've already got, the ones in the glass bottles I haven't got yet, I can unlock them. Show me what I bought. But give me a reason to come back. I am still playing Adventure Capitalist 3 months later.
I have a problem with that.
You have a problem? Do you need medical help? I don't know why though. I genuinely don't know why I keep coming back, because it's the most pointless game on the planet. Except I can play it without an internet connection. I'm at the stage now where I basically can't play any games. There's like two games I can currently play, Fallout Shelter and this, because almost everything I haven't played requires an online connection. I think we're in dangerous territory for people who travel, but that's another subject, another time. Post-purchase, okay. So I've tried, hopefully you'll tell me how I've done. I've tried to get across to you a whole bunch of things. I'm going to try and summarize it with this slide. These are the takeaways, really. I hope I've got you to think about games as a leaky bucket, that we will always lose customers, but we want to try and slow that loss and try and encourage as many people to come back as possible. That we can do that through virality, we can do that through creating compelling and joyful experiences, and that's more successful than us trying to squeeze money out of those people. Because guess what happens if we squeeze money out of people? What do? They leave, they churn. So if we don't pay attention to players' joy, we lose them. That's what I hope you take away from this. Also, I've tried to give you some techniques, some types of game in-app purchase, and also some forms that takes. Hopefully, I've done that in a way that gives you a sense that this is an artistic choice that you make as a game designer. You do not want to leave this to a monetization expert, because they are not game designers, mostly. There are a few exceptions. They are very few exceptions. But you are game designers, and yes, of course, you should be informed by advice of great stats and data, but you know your game design. And as long as you test it and you base it on evidence as well, you're going to be better positioned to do this than other people. So once we've got those techniques and you focus on this idea that we want to deliver an expectation of future value, then what we have to pay attention to is the post-purchase moment. So I don't care if you convert somebody to buy one time. I want them to convert to buy five times. If your customers are only spending once, you've failed. Them spending once means that your post-purchase experience is terrible because they do not feel so good about buying that they want to do it again. That's really the takeaway I want you to get on. How are the purchases that those players making affecting other people? Have you asked that question when you do that design? How are you increasing the scope of their play? How are you making it so they can play more and feel better about being more engaged with your game? Have you shown them what their purchase got them, what their money bought them? Have you made it possible for them to feel good about what money they've spent? Or have you hidden that from them? Because if you hide it from them, are they going to feel good about it? If you make them feel good about it, and I'm not just say, you spent this much money. No, I'm talking about, look at all this great, crazy stuff you've invested and built in, and some of it we've paid for, some of it we've not paid for. But make me feel good about that. Make that amazing. And above all, give me a reason to come back and do it again. We only do that when we respect players. We only do that when we respect that the free player is as valid a player as the paid player, and that we can use the transition from this kind of moment of free playing to, you know, video ads or in-app purchases, we can tie a seamless journey from not paying to watching ads to playing and paying. And that journey makes happier players. And on that note, thank you very much.